Welcome back to The Doubters, everybody, on Thursday, the 25th of June. And I've got a guest here with me today. I've got Frank Starling, who's joining us from a hot and sweaty London. Do you want to say hello, Frank?
Hi, everyone. Definitely it's hot and sweaty over here.
Definitely hot and sweaty in the UK at the moment. So, yeah. And just to say, so Frank's here, and but his bandwidth is looking a bit low, so we're going to try and keep the video on, hopefully, as long as possible. We may have to turn your video off, Frank, if it just gets a bit too choppy, but we'll see how we get on with that. We'll work with what we got. Yeah, so this is The Doubters. Welcome. I've got one person here joined me live today. The waiting room's off, so people may come and go. They know the deal. You know the deal here. You're always welcome, but you don't have to come. So welcome to the person who's joined us here live, and welcome to people who are watching us on record. Very good of you to join us. So this is The Doubters. This is my private online community. This is a learning space where I explore all the aspects related to this concept about the purpose of self-doubt that I've been developing for the last couple of years now. As I said, I've got Frank here joining me today from London. And Frank is a diversity and inclusion consultant. You are the founder and MD of a consultancy, an organisation called Variety Pack. And you were listed as one of the top 30 BAME leaders in 2019 in the UK. And that's a great achievement. Great to have you here, Frank. Is there anything you want to say? Is there anything people need to know about you before you start? Obviously, I just got that little description off your website. So what do you want people to know?
No, good to be here. And thanks for having me, Olivia. I think in terms of what to say about me, I think you kind of gave a great summary there. I think for me and the company and what we do with Variety Pack, the overall purpose is how do we bring meaning to diversity and inclusion? Because I think it's a phrase that kind of gets thrown around quite a bit. It's a very complicated topic. I think a lot of organizations maybe struggle with, you know, how to follow through on the principles of diversity and inclusion. So my overall goal is to help people become the best version of themselves, irrespective of what their intersectionality is. And that's a kind of a real important thing to me for a number of personal experiences, but also because of my principles and beliefs as well. So.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you for that. And that's definitely, we're going to get into the meat of what you've just said there, definitely, because it's totally why I've invited you here to talk today. We have got the topic of the challenge of authenticity. And the reason, I'll just give a little bit of background, maybe the reason I've asked you here to talk about that is because I did an episode on this a few weeks ago, and I spoke about the relationship between self-doubt and authenticity as I see it and as I've been experiencing it through this work. And so I'll probably talk a little bit more about that. And you talked about how your mission really is to help people become the best version of themselves, whatever their intersectionality. And I would say that very much meets with my mission really as a life coach as well. So I work with people on an individual level, and you're working with people on an organisational level. So I guess that's the difference here. As I see it now, that might not be quite the case. And just to say, I've not worked in an organisation since 2013. I've been liberated completely, which is wonderful. So anything that I kind of say about organisations should be bear that in mind when I talk about this stuff. You know, my thinking and my understanding may not be completely current, but anyway, we'll see what comes out. I spoke about the relationship between self-doubt and authenticity, and I really wanted to explore this topic further. I wanted to have a deeper conversation about this, and I thought you were the perfect person really to talk about this, Frank, because I heard you on a webinar in January. It was one of the Bright Talk webinars, which are brilliant. They do lots of topics around diversity and inclusion. There's some great conversations going on there. And I heard you talking on there, and I really sensed and heard your desire for approaching diversity and inclusion in a really authentic manner. And I also sensed a bit of frustration from you around that as well. Could be right, could be wrong there. And then since then, you've set up your own organisation, Variety Pack. Your website's fantastic. I encourage anyone, go and have a look at Frank's website. It's really great. It's a great blog on there, some great content. And on there, I love how you present diversity, actually, because I can really see the intention of wanting to get beneath and understanding exactly what this thing is that we're dealing with. So that really comes across on your website. I see that. So I kind of heard this frustration with you, and perhaps we'll start. So, you know, your mission with your organisation, you talk about getting beyond performative diversity, and you talk about the need for authenticity. And so what I hear from that is perhaps experience of performative diversity and inauthentic diversity, because obviously that's your mission. And to create an organization with that mission, that's a big thing to do, right? You know, that's a big thing to put your mission to. So I just wonder if you could maybe start by, if you don't mind, just telling us a little bit about what's behind that and what your experience is.
Sure, yeah, I would love to. And I think diversity and inclusion in many ways has become somewhat subjective. I think everyone, every organization and every individual has got their own kind of definition of what it is and how it works for them. I guess my definition is this idea of, irrespective of your background, you have the opportunity to reach your full potential. And within the context of an organization, that is an organization respecting you for who you are, but understanding some of the challenges that you may have had necessary to reach senior leadership positions, to be engaged in the organization. Every single person's experience is really different. I mean, I'll share a little bit about mine. I grew up on a council estate in a single parent household. You know, we didn't come from a wealthy family at all. My mum was literally looking after two kids. I was the youngest at the time. Well, I still am now, but I was a baby when we were in such a kind of harsh position. And I grew up in a London which at that time was very different to what we see now. You know, I'm fortunate to have grown up in East London, which is kind of very diverse. But growing up through the kind of the 80s and 90s, you know, I remember seeing just a lot of prejudice and a lot of racism, which was kind of out there. I think as of today, of course, we have a great level of tolerance in our society. But at the same time, we have a lot of implicit bias and unconscious bias, which we're not always willing to talk about and discuss. And the conversation of intersectionality and lived experience is a particularly sensitive one, because every person's lived experience is different. My lived experience is different to someone who's maybe had more economic privilege. What I believe in and what I think is really important is, how do we create safe spaces to have these conversations about those differences? How do we acknowledge as opposed to shut down when we are challenged with opinions that we don't necessarily agree with? And that is something which is kind of certainly a principle of mine. You know, I never go out to shut people's opinions down. You know, even through the work in my company, Variety Pack, one of the core goals that we try to live by is allowing organizations to kind of almost see where they need to improve themselves, and just making suggestions and taking them on that journey, as opposed to kind of dictating what is best practice, because technically best practice is different for every company. And of course, you know, my experience in the working world has been a strange one at times. You know, I'm used to working, obviously I don't work in directly in a company, I just work with organizations now, but for example, I worked in property for about 10 years. And within that time, it was a very kind of homogenous culture. You know, I never really saw individuals that looked like me, the organization, whether that be in junior positions or in senior level positions when I started some time ago now. And that in itself takes some getting used to, because I was used to a London which was very diverse, and then I was working with an organization which wasn't very diverse, and I couldn't quite get my head around the difference there. And it doesn't always allow you to bring your whole self to work. You don't necessarily feel entirely safe as an individual. It's not to say that I didn't have some amazing colleagues around me, because I did, but at the same time, there are little things that kind of creep up from time to time, which show that an organization maybe isn't aware of its blind spots, whether that be, how employees are recruited, how they are promoted in an organization, or even the handling of disagreements around things like microaggression, right? You know, these kind of moments in a company where things are said maybe from an ethical place, from an unintentional place, but can cause real anxiety to other individuals. It's like, you know, when the first time where someone questioned whether I was British in the workplace, and that wasn't particularly nice. You know, I'm a Brit, but ultimately, because of the color of my skin, they'd assume that I'm not British in some way. Mm-hmm. So again, this is not to chastise people. I think the whole point of us having these discussions is to kind of open up these safe spaces where we can talk about our differences and celebrate those differences. So I've had a multitude of personal experiences, but I think for me, the biggest driver is this idea of every single person deserves the right to be the best version of themselves. And how can we help organizations to create cultures and environments that allow for that to happen, irrespective of your skin color, of how you identify, of your gender? I think this is an opportunity that should be open for every single person out there.
Thank you for that background, Frank. It's good to hear your story and some of your experiences there. And there's so much that you said. I think a couple of things just to pick up on is that, you know, really, you know, how you talk about, well, this is part of all of us. You know, this kind of the challenge of diversity is a challenge for everybody. And I think something that I've seen that's frustrated me a little bit, as I said, on the outside, really looking in, is how diversity has been sort of hijacked by, or the business case. We need to create the business case for diversity to you know, that this is going to be profitable for the organization to be diverse. And it's like, you know, so that for me feels a bit like a challenge, really, to get beyond. And then maybe tacking it on to a department in the organization, whereas actually, you know, this is what you're talking here, this is a challenge for all of us. And this meets with something that I see in my work around self-doubt. It was so I came into this project just sort of I qualified as a life coach, and I was thinking, right, what do I want to do with this skill that I've got? And not being sort of chained to an organisation, I was very free to explore that. And self-doubt has been, you know, one of my lifelong challenge, really. And so I started to work with that. And then I realised, as a result of that, that this was applicable to the diversity and inclusion case, if you like, you know, because people who come from underrepresented backgrounds or have sort of challenges of fitting in, we will experience higher levels of self-doubt generally, which means that we will probably question ourselves before we will question what else is out there. So that's how I came into it. And and what I've discovered, because actually it's interesting talking about background, because, you know, you wouldn't, looking at me, obviously I'm a woman, but, and that's kind of my, you know, obvious challenge by looking at me, I'm a woman, but I'm white, you know, my heritage is probably the most monoculture you could ever really, really think about. We come from a kind of one town in the northeast of England, both sides of my family, you know, and so, like, on the face of it, it's like I don't have that sort of the racial challenge experience that you've had, but then on another side of it, I still had my challenges, because I grew up in a family where there was addiction was rife. I'm the youngest of six, I'm the only girl, so that kind of, like, I was kind of born into a family where I didn't really feel like I never felt like I belonged, you know. So I had that whole kind of, like, I would say, almost like gender confusion growing up. I didn't want to be a girl, you know. So there was sorts of, you know, so, you know, what I'm trying to say is it can come in many guises. And I think in some ways we're all challenged by this sense of like, how do I belong in the world? Is that what you see?
I think it's a major point. I mean, self-doubt has been a kind of a gremlin in my life, I would say, that I've had to wrestle to the ground over and over again.
Ooh.
And I think in many different ways. I think I say gremlin, multiple gremlins.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm cringing because
different version of self-doubt.
Yeah, my approach is about embracing self-doubt and bringing it in rather than wrestling it. But anyway, we can get into that if you want to, but we don't have to.
I think let's get into it for sure. I think I actually went on that journey of embracing what I'm fearful of, and that was the point where it changed my life entirely.
Okay.
That was the point where I almost kind of became unbothered about these thoughts and feelings that one can have.
You became unbothered by them.
In many ways, kind of hold you back. I started to kind of become unbothered, and then that was the first stage. And I think the second stage was, how do I challenge myself to just dive into that self-doubt and to dive into that fear? And what am I capable of if I can succeed by getting through it? I think the very first challenge for me was when I found out my father passed away. I was about 13 years old, and I had never met the guy, so I didn't have a relationship with him. However, it hurt at that age, because I thought, I'm never going to meet this person who I'm meant to be 50% of, right? You know, what is this person actually like? And that is the point where I started to kind of doubt my place. You mentioned, you know, to your point in terms of your kind of identity there, that is something that I was really kind of struggling with, but more about like, how am I going to grow up to be, you know, the man that I wanted to be when I was older, without necessarily having the right mentors or guides. You know, as amazing as my mother has always been, sometimes you know, you long for a family like the other families that your friends have, right, where they've got two parents. Mm-hmm. So that was the point where I kind of needed to ask myself, you know, what is going to happen to my future? What kind of person am I going to be? And through a lot of self-doubt, that actually turned me on to personal development, where I kind of started to think, how can I learn skills which I just don't have, which I'll need in the house? So that is a principle that has kind of stayed with me for my entire life and served me incredibly well. But at that age, at the ripe age of 13, that's when I started to learn how to change light bulbs, put flat packs together. By 15, I think I was laying floorboards. Mm-hmm. And that all came of this kind of fear of feeling somewhat inadequate to other individuals at who were kind of the same age as I was at the time. And and I had a kind of a reoccurring theme as I got older, and a lot of it was connected to my socioeconomic background, because I thought, okay, because I don't I don't come from any financial privilege, will I ever be able to have a successful career? Will I ever be able to hold conversations in exactly the same way as other people do? And my first full-time job, I went into full-time work to support my mother and my household. My first full-time job, I was 17 years old, and I worked on Ryman's on Upper Street in Islington, if anyone knows the shop in North London. It was not a glamorous job whatsoever. The salary certainly was not glamorous at all. But honestly, it was a moment in my life where I thought, this is not good enough for me. It's not that there's nothing wrong with working in retail at all. However, my aspirations were just entirely different. Mm. And that was the moment where I thought, I need to just work my hardest. I need to learn my way out of this situation and go on that journey of doing it. So I'd say self-doubt has you know, it started off as a really kind of horrible gremlin. And now I realize that it's a bit like the emotion of anger, right? You might say to yourself that it's not a good thing to be angry at times, but sometimes anger in the right doses and delivered in the right kind of way is a really kind of passionate and useful emotion to have. And that's kind of my relationship, I would say, with self-doubt now and how I use it as a mechanism in terms of personal development. So totally off piece, but
I'm fascinated to hear it, and I found that really powerful to hear how you got into that. And you talked about and learn to go towards it, really, and the growth that you got from that. And so and also I was relating to a lot of your story as well. I lost my father when I was 13 too. He died, although I did know him. You know, he was kind of present. You know, as present as he could be. And and also I didn't go on to further education. I just went out and worked, left school and worked at 16, kind of, you know, anyway. But I guess what I'm curious about, and let's, you know, we'll come back onto the topic, but what I'm curious about is what do you think drove you for that approach? Because there's so many ways that you could have gone at that age. You know, at age of 13, reflecting on my own journey, there's so many routes that you could have taken than the one you did, you know?
Yeah, it's a question that I had to figure out the answer of as I got older, because it was a kind of a consistent drive which I had. Yeah. And I think in many ways I owe it to my mother and her perseverance. It's because here's a person that was, you know, looking after two children. We weren't in a good condition. We weren't in a great place at that point. She had two jobs and she was studying at the same time. She was a mum in her 30s. And as I, you know, even as a young child, I could recognize the types of sacrifices that she was making, the type of commitment. And I think it just inspired me to see, you know, what is possible under duress, you know, even under a very tough circumstance. Like being a single parent is no joke. You know, it is an incredibly difficult task to execute on. I mean, being a parent. So I think out of respect for, you know, what she was doing and how she was trying to kind of just at least give me a platform to have a life, that definitely was a massive driver. At the same time, I was very keen on carving my own journey. I think the situation that had happened with my father was quite a negative one. And, you know, knowing that this person kind of had abandoned me really made me feel quite sour in many ways. So I guess I thought, you know, what is my legacy going to be like as I get older? It's just somewhat profound thing to think about when you're a very young teenager, I guess. But that was enough of a catalyst to really light a flame in me to say, well, look, if you're going to do something and if you're going to make it a success, then you're going to have to work incredibly hard and incredibly smart at the same time. It's going to take a lot of commitment and facing a lot of fear. And at the same time, it was, you know, how do I build my confidence? Mirrored when I was working in retail, and I got a management position at 19 years old, and I was managing people who were 30, 35, 40 years old, and I was just, that time, to lack so much confidence on it, and telling myself every single morning that I had the confidence to execute. Right. And strangely enough, over time, that really helped me to build my true confidence and, you know, build obviously the person that I am today. So definitely a combination of things. Yeah. I would say the last thing would be when you kind of see that success happen. So out of all that fear and all the time spent learning, I would say for the majority of my life, I've always had two jobs. You know, I've had whatever I'm doing as my day job, and in the evening, I'm constantly learning. And that is a task. You know, it's definitely not a chore, but it's most definitely a task. But seeing how I could change, almost me being a modular person, was a really exciting realization that learning can literally change your life. And and it did for me. It most definitely did. You know, to your point, there are many different ways that I could have gone at that age. But luckily I chose the path of personal development, and it was difficult, but it was worth it.
Yeah, fantastic, brilliant. I guess the reason I asked that question, because I did go down the path of addiction. You know, that was my route anyway, and yeah, came on personal development a bit later. But it's all part of the journey, you know, I think. And it's really inspiring to hear your the influence that your mum had on you. And actually, my mum had quite a big influence on me in that context as well, because she studied, she went back to study late at life. She achieved a master's degree in her 60s. So, you know, she really demonstrated to me that it's never too late. She's always had that drive, you know, so that's been amazing to have.
And I would say I was just, you know, as much as I kind of speak about the journey there, it was a kind of a unique set of circumstances where I think because I had to also just help to support the household and kind of bring home income, I think this just gave me, you know, another thing to focus on as well, knowing that like week by week, like that was the main focus. So yeah, definitely a combination of things.
Yeah, kind of needs must. Yeah,
absolutely.
So what brought you into working in diversity and inclusion? What how did you get into that field?
Yeah, there's a couple of things really. I mean, the first and most obvious one is kind of my lived experience and maybe just, you know, the some of the circumstances that I've been in London, in and out of the workplace, experiencing, unfortunately, racism on a number of occasions, which obviously is not great in any situation. But I think the more kind of recent time where I decided that maybe see some the challenges that were present diversity and inclusion was about the local council to tackle unemployment with young black men, which at the time was the highest in the UK, just within my my borough of Hackney. And I could see there that if you came from a particular background, if you didn't have access to economic privilege, then the chances of you having just a career, let alone a successful one, were particularly hard. And I wanted to do my best to be part of that solution through mentorship. And I think that really gave me an insight into, you know, some of the kind of deep challenges that not just happen in our society, but clearly happening in the workplace as well. At the same time, I think I've always had a passion to pay it forward. You know, knowing some of the challenges that I've been through in my lifetime. Of course, I run a limited company. It's not a charity, but at the same time, I don't just run diversity and inclusion because it's something which is trending. You know, I run this company because I have a passion to create systemic change in the future. That's incredibly difficult to do. You can only kind of own a particular niche and chip away at that niche. But through the work of my day job and through my mentorships, I mentor a number of young who are from underrepresented backgrounds. These things combine, I think, help me to focus on, you know, my personal mission of this kind of authentic approach to diversity and inclusion and actually living my values, which is not necessarily something I was always that aware of. You know, the days I was working in property, I was very much kind of had my head down and was focusing on providing for my household. That was the main focus. However, over time, I, you know, with this idea of paying it forward, I really wanted to kind of bring it back to, you know, how can I make sure that I'm sowing seeds for other people as well?
And your drive and your passion for this topic are absolutely clear. And, you know, getting a bit of context in your story, you know, you can see how that has built up over time. And what are the challenges that you see to achieving, I guess, what we'd call an authentic approach to diversity?
I think there are a number of challenges in achieving kind of true diversity and inclusion, authentic diversity and inclusion. I think the first challenge is, you know, how aware is your organization? How self-aware is your organization? Because implicit bias, unconscious bias, unintentional discrimination, whatever you want to call it, it is present in most organizations. As nice as people are, as nice as we can be, it doesn't necessarily mean that we don't have blind spots. So I think the first thing to look at is, you know, where are your blind spots in your organization? How can you identify what those blind spots are? It might be how you recruit. It might be how you promote people. It could be just your general practice in terms of maybe you've got really bad gender pay gaps and that's just emerged over time and you've only turned around and looked at where you are now. So I think the first stage is identifying what level of bias you might have within your organization. And I think the second stage is, you know, how can you create a plan that works for you, you know, within the remit of your resources. And I personally think that plans have to include all voices at the table. I think sometimes where I see organizations fall down is they say we want to follow diversity and inclusion. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to focus on gender parity and only gender parity. And therefore, they have a very kind of skewed sense of D&I is, and instead just focus on, you know, how can we get an equilibrium, let's say, in senior positions of men and women. And that is one aspect, and that's incredibly important. But there are so many other pillars to focus on. And I guess my want for organizations when I work with companies is, how can we make sure we're looking at intersectionality across the board, looking at a slightly broader view of what D&I means, especially if you're working in a society, let's say, like London, or any kind of, you know, busy central city, which is diverse, which does have a diversity of voices and talent and minds. How can we ensure that they, you know, they feel welcome in your organization? So I think there are a number of things that a company can do, and it just takes a thoughtful approach. No knee jerking based on what's trending. Yeah. Just really thinking about, do we want this to be in the fabric of our organization? Is it really that important to us? Because if it is, the business benefits are entirely clear. The moral benefits are obviously very obvious. But at the same time, as a brand, it means you're authentically standing for something that I think much of society stands for.
So this, I think a couple of things that you said there was, well, firstly, it's about how getting all the voices at the table, and how it'd be very easy just to focus on one, like, let's get this one thing right. Because I think maybe part of the challenge is that it is, it's so wide, right? There's such a wide arena of this challenge, you know, there's so many different aspects to it. How to keep a person included? So it would be quite easy to get overwhelmed if you're trying to write policies, for example, let's cover this in a policy, let's cover that in a policy. I mean, I'm so glad I'm not working in organizations and having to deal with all of that stuff. So maybe that's one thing. And then the other thing, you talk about intersectionality there. And I think this is something that I think I'm quite interested. So this is, feels like a real key to diversity, because obviously diversity brings strength. So my husband and I, we're really into conservation. We keep bees and stuff like that. And, you know, we understand diversity. If you look at diversity in the countryside, diversity brings strength. So where you have a monoculture, if you like, that creates a weakness and a fragility. And when you have a diverse sort of area. You know, there's strength there. There's lots of different species kind of thrive in that area. And I guess that's how a way of looking at it in the workplace. But you talk about intersectionality there, and that's about everybody being able to bring themselves rather than having to fit to what the organisation wants you to be. Do you know what I mean? Is that correct, what I'm saying there?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely, yeah. No, definitely, Olivia. I think, you know, for me, intersectionality equals your lived experience. And do you work in an organisation that allows you to bring your lived experience to work without prejudice, you know, without it hindering your chances of promotion, without you being overlooked for the next key position? You know, I think a lot of people almost become brandless because they're very scared to be themselves. So they heavily assimilate the cultures that they're working in. You know, they tend to kind of, you know, and I've been a victim of that. When I was working in property, I wanted to make sure that I worked on how I articulated my sentences. You know, I grew up on a council estate in Hackney. Yeah. I didn't grow up speaking like this. You know, I haven't gone to some kind of posh university or anything like that. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I just haven't. Yeah. But when I was about 14 or 15, I recognized that. I think I was about 15 years old when I saw a lot of my friends were speaking kind of local London slang, and that's all good. But at the same time, I thought to myself, well, in order to have any chance in the corporate world, I'm probably going to have to work on how I communicate. Yeah. So I really focused on that, and that improved over time. But when I started in property, I really had to challenge myself because I was working with clients who were entirely different to me. And in many ways, I was very scared about bringing my kind of unpolished self to work, right? And I think intersectionality means different things for different people. But fundamentally, if we can create cultures that embrace people's lived experience, it allows people to be truly engaged in their work. It allows people to naturally be more productive because they're not burdened with having to hold a very heavy facade. It's almost like wearing a suit of armor every single day you come to work. And sitting there with that suit of armor, I mean, that is literally the feeling a lot of the time, just not being allowed to be yourself. So I think the first thing certainly any company can do is, you know, how do we allow people to just kind of be themselves, obviously within the realms of professionalism, of course. But creating that safe space, I think, is crucial. It's crucial.
Yeah. And I love how you talk about safety a number of times. For me, that feels really key. And, you know, I think you really hit the nail on the head here from an individual point of view, but also an organisational point of view, where people are scared of being themselves. And this is what I work with. You know, this is what I see on an individual level when working with self-doubt. Because that question about self-doubt, where a person doubts themselves, takes us directly to where a person's not feeling good enough and not accepting themselves, excluding themselves almost, those parts of ourselves that we've excluded and that we don't want to bring to the world. You know, we know we're there, but we don't want to bring them to the world. You know, we're frightened of being ourselves. So a lot of the work really I do, the first principle, I guess, around this is self-acceptance. And when we can accept ourselves, then we can bring more of ourselves to the world. But that's one part of it, isn't it? When a person can do their own work and do that, but then creating that kind of psychological safety in an organisation to allow that to happen and to make sure that a person's able to come, you know, with everything that they are, all of their challenge, but also all of their gifts as well, you know? And surely that's when you get the best out of a person. Where are we with this? I mean, you know, in organisations, what are you seeing?
I think we're a long way off before having this idea where we hire people based on value alignment, as opposed to whether they will fit in the culture, because I think that's the first kind of fault line. And I think the second fault line is having a culture that embraces differences. You know, it doesn't say, well, this is how we do things here. Because I think that is often what happens, especially in large organizations. You know, we're so strict in terms of what we expect of people, how we expect them to work. And sometimes we need to be a little bit more kind of malleable, because as long as the outcomes are the same, and I think that is a crucial point to focus on, is, of course, we want businesses to be successful. We want to make sure that the people that work for us are productive. And over the course of a year, we want to be growing, not dying. You know, ultimately, that is the goal, I think, for any organization. So even if you look at where we are now, within a global pandemic, within a time where a lot of kind of political sensitivities are at an all-time high globally, markets are volatile. This would be, you know, one of the best opportunities to ensure you've got diversity at the table, because how on earth could you actually navigate a lot of these constant changes without having the right kind of minds there? And this is not to say that businesses with a homogenous culture can't be successful, because we've seen that in the likes of big tech, for example. A lot of these tech companies aren't very homogenous, so technically they can be successful. However, I think even if you look at the attitude of the consumer, the average consumer is now demanding more from organizations. You know, we've seen that in terms of how, let's say, the quality of food has changed in restaurants, for example. You know, I remember in the early days in London, okay, you have one or two kind of good restaurants, but the majority of them were okay only. Yeah. And over time, actually, the consumer standards were so high that actually you wouldn't survive on a particular strip unless you met that standard. And I think the same thing is happening with what we demand from our work cultures. I think in order to attract the best talent now, that same individual is demanding that they work in an inclusive culture. They're demanding that their leadership is embracing diversity and inclusion. So really, you can either kind of be behind the cusp on that, or look at how you can modify, make sure you're suitable for what will not only be the future of work, but it will be, I think, a core pillar going forward. And it obviously, as much as we've talked about it over the last few decades, I think what we've seen over the last 4 to 5 years is a number of strides that have been made in diversity and inclusion, which have just changed hearts and minds. And I think that's set to continue.
Fantastic. Yeah. I'm going to open up. If anybody who's here live wants to come on and make a contribution or ask a question or speak to Frank, while we're on the recording, then just unmute yourselves and come on and put your camera on if you want to, but you don't have to. So I'll leave that space to you. But we're also going to leave a bit of time after the recording if you don't want to come on the recording. That's absolutely fine. So it looks like Ellie's going to come on and ask a question. Hey, Ellie.
Hello. Hi, Frank. So I really connected with the way you talked about how you worked in property, and it was a very white environment. I work in advertising, and it is about over 80% of employees are white, and over 85% of C-suite employees are white as well. So like for me, working in media, it's like really hard to see yourself in those environments. And I think, you know, echoing all the points that have been discussed in this session, like I think it does instill like small seeds of self-doubt. I've always been proud to say, or in recent years, that I've been like unapologetically myself at work, but I think that's not always possible for lots of people. And I think for me, working in media, I find that the big problem probably comes culturally before you get to recruitment levels. And I was wondering if you had any advice or any words on how to reach out to younger people to help them like overcome their self-doubt and earlier in age, so by the time they get into the workplace, that feeling of, you know, inclusivity is instilled in them. They don't feel like they have to, you know, look for themselves at boardroom level, because that probably still won't be happening for another 5 to 10 years. Like lots of industries are very, very behind in diversity and inclusivity. And I think it's kind of the gaps in that have really been shown in recent weeks with all these like really vacuous and empty statements from companies and businesses and employers saying we pledge to do better, and everyone's kind of like, it's a bit too late really. But you know, I guess any advice for like reaching out to younger people that where perhaps you can have an impact to get them into businesses sooner and feel like they can climb the ladder quicker perhaps?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Elia. Thank you so much for sharing your lived experience there, because I think, you know, like many industries that are overwhelmingly white in respect to, you know, especially in relation to the cities in which they work in, it doesn't always quite, it's quite a difficult challenge to overcome. And with young people, I work with a lot of young people. I'm also a London Enterprise Advisor for the Mayor of London. In that role, I help with careers plans and do a bit around kind of diversity and inclusion. And I would say in terms of like how to get to young people, it's definitely, if you're doing it by an organization, by a company, it's definitely worth doing talks at secondary schools, making your organization visible and talking about, the lived experience of what it's like to work in this industry. To your point, you know, will we ever see representation which truly kind of embodies the way society looks? It's hard to say. It's going to take a very long time and number of leaders to kind of wake up and decide that they're going to put budget and commitment towards something like that. However, I definitely can relate to that challenge where there was next to no representation. Growing up in London, I never saw any senior black men apart from Trevor McDonald and Will Smith. You know, I barely kind of saw any individuals there who, you know, I could identify with. And that is an ongoing issue. And I think it's really kind of talking to young people about what the lived experience is like, why they can still own their personality, bring themselves to work, why that's incredibly important to demand that kind of culture when they're going into the working world. But I think not hiding any of the truth, because it's incredibly competitive out there. And especially if you, again, if you look at the, if you look at intersectionality, you, every element of intersectionality is, to go back to the analogy of a suit of armor, it's that suit of armor. So sometimes, you know, so for me, it was kind of being, being a black man in London, then it was being a black man from a council estate, then it was being a black man from a low socioeconomic background. I mean, all these things you're kind of carrying with you. So I think the first thing is definitely doing talks at schools, but then the second thing is, you know, looking at mentorship programs with your organization. You know, how can you kind of create accelerators or programs for young interns that are coming through to really support them on that journey? I think in order for young people to be successful, they need to be listened to. They often, if they're coming from an underrepresented background, they're struggling with imposter syndrome. They genuinely don't feel like they, you know, deserve or should have a space within these companies. And we have to catch those feelings. We have to make sure that they are mentored and they're supported so they finally can break the glass ceiling and obviously get into more kind of middle and senior management positions.
That's great. And yeah, I'm really hopeful as I sit here and listen to you, Frank, and Ellie. I know people like Ellie will be out there and being examples of what can be done, you know, standing up and being that example that you didn't have. I feel that's so important, and that's what you're talking to now, being that positive example that someone can look to and say, yeah, you can do it, so I can do it too. And there's so much more of that coming through in the millennial generation, which I'm that's not me, that's not my generation. But, you know, if my work around self-doubt, if it was for anybody, it would be for those young people, really, to come and I talk about claiming our sense of belonging, really, by accepting us, but through self-acceptance. And that's a lifelong journey as well, you know. Seeing self-doubt as a route to growth, seeing it as a positive thing. So self-doubt showing me where I need to grow. So that's one thing I'd say there. But yeah, we'll finish off the recording in a minute. I was just wondering, so obviously Ellie talked there about the you know, the current times and what's happening in organisations, but I feel that there's some positive stuff really coming out of these times now in sort of a post-COVID, post-George Floyd world. I mean, what is your hope now for like the immediate future?
I think my hope... Yeah, I think for the immediate future, for the short term, my hope is that we can just have conversations about what is important to people across the board and not shut them down. Because I think that that has been a challenge, certainly for companies in the UK, where, yes, we want to hear about diversity and inclusion, but only through this kind of very small and safe box, which is not in any way controversial or in any way rocks the boat. And I think in order to respect people's intersectionality, that lived experience, sometimes those conversations are somewhat uncomfortable, but allowing them to happen, A, gives you an opportunity to learn about your blind spots, and B, really empowers people to be the best version of themselves. So I too am hopeful about the future. And at very least, I think kind of a lot of the recent events, which have been incredibly tragic, have invited a new type of discussion, which I hope we continue to have and continue to have it in a really meaningful and practical way.
Yeah, I love that. It's about listening, about keeping listening, isn't it? And I think one of the things I've seen is about how almost, you know, how we slowed down a little bit in this period of time in order, and that maybe put us in a more sort of listening place. Because one of the challenges I see is about how we're so busy and efficiency, you know, striving for efficiency all the time. And I think, you know, I'd love to just slow down a bit. So let's not be so efficient. Let's just sit back and listen and allow space and that create that safe space. You know, I'd love to see a bit more of that. Yeah. Great. All right, Frank, well, we'll finish off the recording now and we'll leave a little bit of time for anybody who wants to come on the end. So just thank you so much for joining me here today. It's been a real privilege to have you here. I've enjoyed our conversation. Is there anything you'd like to say? Is, you know, what are you available for? Where can people find you?
No, thanks, Olivia, for having me on the show. And it's great to be able to kind of just share views. And as you say, like, if we can get to this point of authentic diversity and inclusion, I think everyone will be happy. If anyone wants to talk about it, do add me on LinkedIn, Frank Starling. You can check out my website, which is varietypack.co. And I've got a few blogs on there and some interesting thoughts around diversity and inclusion as well.
Brilliant. Great. Thank you so much, Frank. So I'll finish off the recording now. And just to say, next week I'm going to be joined by coach and leadership consultant Chris Sheroy, who is a co-founder of a company called Mavericks Unlimited. And we're going to talk about being a maverick, what it takes to be a maverick and come up with truly creative new solutions, and how that relates to self-doubt as well. So thank you for joining me today here. Thank you for everybody who listened to the recording, and I'll see you next week.